The Mormon Expression Podcast is made possible through the support of our listeners. Consider making a donation or purchasing a subscription today at mormonexpression.com. The books you hear discussed on the podcast and others that we recommend can be purchased by clicking on the store link. And to those of you who have already contributed, thanks.
All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and today we're continuing our third in the series of our conference reviews. We're listening to conference, so you all don't have to. This was the 180th semi-annual, distributed by Bonneville Distribution and copyright by Intellectual Reserve, both LDS-owned companies. And today we've got a full panel of bright and interesting people to help us out. First of all, our welcoming back our old friend Niall. Hey, Niall.
Hey, hello, everybody.
And Niall, you're coming in from Oslo, right?
No, I'm coming in from Sandefjord, Norway.
Okay, is that near Oslo?
No.
No.
By Utah terms, it would be like Provo or Ogden to Salt Lake, but really the distance, it's sort of expanded. You know how it is in the South where it's just small roads going everywhere? That's kind of how it is. So it's a good hour and a half away, even though it would only be like going to Ogden or whatever.
All right. Welcome back, Niall, and thanks for listening to conference.
Oh, you're welcome.
And continuing the panel, she was with us just a couple weeks ago, Tierza. Welcome back, Tierza.
Hi, thanks.
Thank you. And we have Devin. Tierza, where are you calling from?
I'm from Delaware.
Delaware, all right. And we have Devin. Devin, you've helped us out with conference once or twice before.
Yes, and I'm here in the currently sitting in the shadow of the Everlasting Hills in Salt Lake.
All right, it's great to have the home front recognized. And we have Scott. Hey, Scott, this is your first time.
Hey, this is my first time.
All right, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Atlanta.
Atlanta. All right. So y'all got to see the first session of the conference and started out, not really with a bang, but just start out as normal. Of course, Thomas Monson was the overseer. What do they call it? Presiding. Yeah, he was presiding. And Henry Eyring was conducting this session. Tommy Monson started out by announcing that they completed four temples since the last conference. They were Vancouver, one in Vancouver, one in Arizona, one in Kiev. And do you guys remember where the fourth one was? I didn't write that one down.
The Philippines.
In the Philippines. That was right. And they announced five new ones, one in Lisbon, Portugal, Indianapolis, Indiana.
Veneta, the Philippines, yeah.
Yeah, Hartford, Connecticut. And then my favorite, which I will visit personally, right after I go to the donkey show in Tijuana, Mexico.
Did you hear the audible gasp like from the audience when he announced Tijuana? I was kind of surprised. There was a gasp I heard over the TV.
Don't let the naysayers say the church is not doing its part to stem illegal immigration into the United States. They're going to keep the natives there with their own temple.
Drug dealers have souls too.
Yeah. Why not? And then Monson talked about missionary work a little bit. Nothing real interesting there. No, you're supposed to go on a mission.
He seemed to put out an admonition that they really needed more couple missionaries. So he, told people, and that's the first time. Well, I guess maybe not the first time, but he took a lot of time encouraging them to prepare and make sure that they planned that into their retirement, things like that.
Yeah, it seems like they say that every conference, don't they? I mean, isn't that one of the standards?
They don't usually stress the senior missionaries. They always do missionary work, but not the senior missionaries.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not in the demographic, so I don't pay that much attention. They do use, I don't know if you noticed, that they used a little bit nuanced language when they're talking about the men versus the women. sisters make a valuable contribution. You know, it's kind of like the, you know, like the special kid in the class who gets a special award, you know, like best participant, that sort of thing. They use that sort of language when they talk about sisters.
We're just yeah. special spirits of the missionary work.
Yeah, thanks, sisters. You guys do such great special things. Thanks for coming out. Thanks for showing up. It's wonderful.
That's what Elder Holland said, right? You're just wonderful, even though we don't pay any attention to you.
Yeah, so that's the next talk. Jeffrey Holland, you know, he's been lately the bulldog of the church. I was getting ready for some scrappiness, and he was sort of contrite. A nice sort of thanctimony.
That was one big thank you, it seemed
horrible.
Like.
Horrible, horrible talk. Just
I like denial. What was horrible about it? It was
what
nice.
Did he say? I thank you. I'm gracious. I'm thank you. I'm gracious. I'm thank you, gracious. Like the only thing worse than all the thank yous is the crappy jokes.
I think he was in a little bit of penance for his last couple of conferences where he's been sort of, like I said, more scrappy.
His attempts at humor seemed just a little bit strained. But other than that, it was kind of not very memorable.
I did notice that he used, to all of our non-Mormon friends out there, he used a key veiled Mormon term. He said, be voice. Did you guys hear that? Of course, be voice is a term for when you pray in a group or pray in a prayer circle, one person prays for the group, and that person is the voice. And they would say, Brother Holland will be the voice. And he used the phrase, be voice. I thought that was interesting. You won't hear that anywhere else.
One thing I did notice is that he opened his talk with thanking people in advance for their sustaining vote. And if you ever wonder, you know, whether there's any, it just kind of illustrates the point that the vote is kind of meaningless and it's a foregone conclusion what it's going to be when you can actually thank them before you even ask them for their sustaining vote.
Yeah. Yeah. And hasn't there been some backlash at the thanking people from the, you know, like you get up in testimony, I'd like to publicly express my love for my wife, that sort of thing. And he kind of did that. But I disagree with Niall. I really liked his talk. I thought it was heartfelt. I thought it was nice. It was sort of a, you know, we appreciate the stuff that all the members do rather than the constant drilling in, you guys have to be better, which comes in the next talks.
There's one thing he did say. This is Scott. There's one thing he did say that I didn't care for. He said, where he told the story about the woman who said, I've never been a leader of anything in the church. I guess I've only been a helper. And he said, God bless you and all the helpers of the church. Basically, sort of elevating the status of the common member. Like it's, and especially the women, because it was. I felt like there was an emphasis on women. Like.
Yeah.
There's no need to, you know, for leadership in the church. There's, it's better where you're at is better than to be a leader.
Well, you know, you can't be a leader unless you have some followers. So you do have to throw a bone to the followers every once in a while. I don't know. What would you say if you were up there?
Yeah, I don't know.
I give Brother Holland thumbs up for this one.
I give him thumbs
up. Yeah, it was good, but bland.
Well, I mean, that kind of goes without saying, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Our next speaker was Rosemary Wixon, who is the primary general president. And gosh damn it, why do they have to talk to us like children? Why do they have to use that cadence? Okay, you women of the church, when you get up there, don't talk like you're talking to little kids. Talk like you're talking to grown-ups.
You're conditioned because you get to talk to little kids all the time. Little kids, teach primary. Tell them that really obnoxious Joseph Smith story.
Yes, the Joseph Smith and the leg. Although I do have to take exception to one thing she said. I don't know if this is true or not, but she said he refused brandy. I really doubt the Smiths had brandy. That would have been sour mash.
Yeah.
Brandy.
Well, I just don't think that story. I mean, if you think about it logically, a 7-year-old is not really as capable of saying, no, Father, I will not take brandy.
Yeah.
It, yeah. What's the lesson in that? Because that was, you know, decades before the word of wisdom.
Yeah, it's a weird story. I think people like it because it, you know, it shows like the prophet's forbearance. You know, never mind that he liked the drinky when he was a grown up, but at seven, you know, it, not so much.
So, well, he's just better than most of us.
Yeah. It's an old saw that comes up all the time, and I don't know. I think it's probably just the pathos of it. You know, you feel sorry for the 7 year old with those, you know, medieval 19th century surgeons digging into his leg, and yeah. You know, it just sounds brave. Yeah, there are, if you go to the old Sunday school manuals, much more gruesome versions of that story that talk about blood soaked sheets and all sorts of things. So it's one we like to return to from time to time. Any other thoughts on Sister Wixen?
She closed with a story about the power of prayer and this family praying in the blizzard. And I was wondering if she really meant, you know, this is the teaching of the power of prayer is what I'm trying to say. What did the prayer do?
I got that the prayer mostly just helped the kids calm down and not be frightened. That's what I got out of it.
This is the story where they were driving around in their van, right? You know, my thoughts always go because as a missionary, I had some experience having to translate some of these talks. So I always think about that sort of thing. You know, if I was like in the Philippines and in a hut and, you know, with the rain leaking through, wondering where I'm going to get the next bowl of rice to feed my kids, and I hear the sad story about the person who's driving their van and has to stop at a hotel because they're a little, you know, I don't know how well the world empathizes with a story like that. You know, the woes of the, by global standards, the woes of the rich. No one's going to jump on my class warfare opening. Come on, Niall.
No, I think I agree with that. It seems pretty, this is the power of prayer. You drove in a blizzard, the road was closed, you drove back down, and you stayed in a hotel.
Right, yeah. You know, it's sort of like, well, don't do that. You know, and we've all been in that situation. I don't mean to make light of how scary you are driving around in the snow with kids, but
make light of it. You know, if that's what the power of prayer is, that it would help somebody get out of a blizzard like that. But, you know, think of all the time. Okay, look at it this way. God's got a list, right? Each little line on this list is a prayer that's to him. And then God's got to arrange things, you know, because he's going to interact with humanity and override free agency, right? So he's only going to do the most important things to his plan. Unfortunately for the starving kids, somebody's in a blizzard. Sorry, kids.
Yeah, but Niall, God can do all things at the same time. So he can find your keys and find my dolly at the same time that he's solving world hunger in the third world. So no one puts God in a box, Niall.
But they put him in a book.
All right. Well, enough of the milk of the session. Let's go to the meat. My favorite talk by far so far at this conference, Claudio Costa. And he's in the 70, right? Did you guys catch, is he in the first quorum of the 70 or is he in one of the other helper quorums?
Presidency.
Oh, he's one of the seven presidents. Okay.
It's one of the big seven.
Yeah. He resurrects old Benson speaking from the grave. The 14 fundamentals gets reread into the record. The famous 1980 talk where Ezra Benson lays out the 14 fighting statements for the prophet.
You know, I thought one of the most interesting things for me about this talk is, do you know how, like, in sacrament meetings, they'll give you a conference talk to talk about that. It's like, so now they give you a conference talk about a previous talk, and then I've got to talk about that in sacrament meeting. I just find it interesting how much they regurgitate past talks.
Yeah, well, this was interesting because it was a full-on regurgitation. They didn't actually read it, but his talk was just a synopsis of Benson's talk. And if you go search for 14 fundamentals on the internet, you'll find about 100, you know, anti-Mormon sites that have the talk up there verbatim. And that's what's fascinating is a lot of people don't consider this talk flattering to the church.
Do you want me to read the points?
Go, yeah, you have in front of you. I've got in front of me. Go ahead, Niall. Read the 14 points.
Okay, I had to reword them because he really threw them out there fast. And they may not be in the correct order, but number one was the prophet speaks for God. This is his official mouthpiece.
Yeah, the prophet is the only man who speaks for
the
Lord.
Only one that can speak for God, yeah.
Okay. Okay, more important than the scriptures. Number three, living prophet outranks a dead one.
Yes.
Number four, the prophet can never lead the church astray. Number, where am I on five? Prophet does not need any credentials to speak on any topic.
Or training.
And still
no,
be.
No training
or
either.
No credentials, training, or knowledge on any level.
Yeah, exactly.
I found that one kind
of
amusing.
This one's good. Number six, does not have to say, thus saith the Lord, for it to be scripture.
Right.
We
call that the Brigham
say what
defense.
Needs to be said and not what's wanted to hear. Number eight, not limited to men's reasoning. So
yeah.
In other words, they don't have to be logical.
Yeah,
in any way.
No reason.
Number nine, oh, I just give me your
he
number nine because I sort of any revelation.
The prophet can receive the prophet can receive revelation on any matter, temporal or spiritual.
Okay, and then number 10 is the prophet. I didn't catch this one. It's something about over civic matters.
May be involved in civic matters. This is the Prop 8 line.
And it says the people who reject him are – no, it's number 11. The only people who reject him are the proud who are learned and the rich. So the proud rich and the proud learned won't listen.
Yeah, what happened to the others, like the lesbians and the gays?
That's a different
topic. I guess they have an out in this one. All right.
Number 12, what he says won't be popular. That's just restating, really. Number 13, the top 15 are prophets?
No. It's actually limiting. The prophet and his counselors make up the first presidency.
Not even the 12?
Yeah, it's to sort of shut down the 12. Go ahead with 14.
Follow and be blessed, reject and burn in hell.
Reject and suffer, yes. Yeah, we've talked about we need to go through these in more detail. There's a lot buried in these statements.
Well, you get the feeling if you really thought about it, that if you really went through these statements for each prophet, that you would kind of have to come to the conclusion that they weren't prophets.
Yeah, this talk is really about So, the restoration restores prophets and authority. And then we've had all these years from 1830 to the present day of all this bullshit that they've been saying that somehow the church has to deal with. And this talk gives the standard on how to deal with all that garbage that's been coming out for the past 170 years. This talk is you know, the whole distinction, and if you listen in conference, they say it all the time, the living prophets. That's because the dead ones who died 20 years ago are an embarrassment. And honestly, that's so the people can't throw the general discourse on you, and a prophet can say whatever pops into his head at any time, and that's okay. We have to obey it. He can die, and then we can distance ourselves from it. There's no culpability. There's no liability. There's no nothing because the next prophet can say something completely different. It can be illogical. It cannot make any sense. It can be about a political issue of the day. We have to follow it till he dies. Whoop! Then we're free, and we can go on a happy way. What a wonderful way to run a church.
No, this is horrible. This is a horrible thing for the Madites, for the apologists right now. I can't wait to see how they're gonna backtrack. Oh well, you know, it wasn't one of the 15 who said this, so it doesn't count.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the classic here is item number four. The prophet will never leave the church astray, and how do we know that? Well, the prophet told us that.
What was interesting, I thought, was that he also said any man. God would strike down any man who tries to lead the children of men astray. And I was thinking, what about John Larson? I don't know. What about Paul H. Dunn?
Hey, wait a minute. I'm not trying to lead the church astray. I'm trying to steady the damn ark.
No. I'll lead the church astray.
I'm more like, what about the popes? You know, if this is true, how is the great apostasy even possible? I mean, why didn't God strike down, you know, whoever was the first pope, Clement or whatever his name was?
Paul? No, Peter.
After Peter. Who's the guy after Peter? I don't know. Who cares? But, you know, why didn't this principle go in the past or in the Book of Mormon or, you know, all those other times? But I've already had this argument with apologists. They just say, well, this is for our time. This doesn't apply anywhere else. But then how do we know this is for our time? Anyway.
The prophet said.
Yeah. And so, you know, like I say, we really have to do another podcast, and we'll have to do it soon since they just brought it up, and really take these statements apart and talk about some of the history, you know, when Benson gave these in the 80s. But wow. I mean, I was really taken aback that this was reread into the record.
Yeah.
It seemed to be a theme through the whole session is the prophet worship. Every talk at least it mentioned it. They had to thank the old God for a prophet. You know, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose. All right. Any other thoughts on Claudio?
Sometimes you worry me. I say something, I suppose. Yeah, moving on.
all right. The next guy was David M. McConkie.
McCarthy. McCarthy?
No, it's McConkie.
It's
and
McConkie.
His talk was wholly unnotable. Maybe you guys have some things, but I think it's important for us to point out who David McConkie was. We have to go back in time to Oscar W. McConkie, who is a senator and on the General Sunday School Board. He had three sons, Oscar W. McConkie Jr., who became head of Curtin and McConkie Law Firm. And he was also on the Sunday School Board and served on all these guys I talked about. They've all been mission presidents and area authorities and bishops and stake presidents. But, you know, you can still go down to DI and find books by Oscar. He wrote some of the Sunday School manuals back in the 60s. Oscar W. McConkie Sr., his father, also had another son named Bruce R. McConkie, who we all know, who married Emile Smith, who is the daughter of Joseph Fielding Smith. And Oscar W. McConkie had another son named Britton McConkie, who was mission president and all stuff. But he had a son named the one and only David M. McConkie, who is also a lawyer for Kirtland M. McConkie, which is the church's law firm. So the McConkie dynasty has long been involved in Sunday school in the highest reaches of the church, including the 12. And they act as the Lord's General Council in these the latter days.
One thing to note that I noticed when hearing him talk, just that a male Sunday school president or, you know, Sunday school general president could also talk to us like we were 4 years old. he kind of, you know, usually that's something that the, you know, primary presidency does. But I couldn't help but feel during the entire thing that he was just kind of talking to us and enunciating very clearly and like he was reading us Dr. Seuss or something.
I think that's the lawyer in him. I always wonder whenever the Sunday school guys come up saying, what do these guys do? Because if you read the Sunday school manual, it says written under the direction of the first presidency. So like, what's his job in the church? I mean, I know he's a lawyer. I know he's out to harass coffee shops and stuff. But, like, what does he do? what does he do at the church office building? Anybody have any clue? What this guy's duties are?
No idea.
It's nepotistic. You don't have to have a thing to do.
Yeah,
and I was just going to comment on the comparison to the primary sort of. I mean, all these auxiliary people, I would love to have one of them, I mean, this would never happen, stand up and actually teach something that had any sort of doctrinal import of any sort. I mean, you know, I mean, not that anybody ever does that in conference anyway, but, you know, they don't talk of, I mean, the auxiliaries are not there to talk about doctrine. They're there to talk about, I don't know what they're there to talk about. They're there to say, look, we have the auxiliaries talking in conference.
Yeah, I agree. And it's something Niall brought up a few minutes ago. A lot of the purposes of conference is to promote the structure. You know, so you get the auxiliaries, you know, this is especially true with the women who talk about the importance of the priesthood and following the brethren and all the time. Because probably the brethren don't like giving talks saying, follow the brethren. But so they get all the auxiliaries to do that. Any other thoughts on Brother McConkie?
It was as boring as Sunday school.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought it was very appropriate.
Yeah, I just like to point out the nepotism. Okay, the next talk was by Todd Christofferson, one of the recent additions to the Quorum of the Twelve. He talked really a lot about the purpose of his talk was consecration, and it's probably an important talk to understand some important Mormon themes and Mormon words, like what we mean when we talk about consecration, which is this idea of really two things in the church, which is you have to be sexually and bodily pure. You know, you can't wear like sleeveless shirts and you can't get tattoos and you can't, you know, think about sex. And also you have to do a whole bunch of work for the church. And that's like, when you do that, you're consecrated to the church.
And I thought the best line of the whole session, and no man best exemplifies this consecration than Thomas S. Monson.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be a toady. I mean, that just goes without saying. He did make another one sentence that I underline, because sometimes I think some of the apologists are trying to distance themselves from this. He said a physical body is necessary for exaltation. Which means that, to explore themes of Mormon theology means exaltation is not necessary for godhood, because Jesus achieved godhood without having a physical body. So Jesus was God without being exalted. But God must have a physical body because he's exalted, a la Todd Christofferson, prophet, seer, and revelator of the last day.
Have to invoke rule number 8 on that. The prophet is not limited to men's reasoning.
That's true. That's true. Okay.
I thought his point on respect for the body was, it actually made me mad. I mean, he did say at one point, didn't he say, those who believe our bodies are the product of evolutionary chance will feel no responsibility to take care of themselves.
Oh, I missed that when my kids were yelling during that one.
I noted that one as well.
Wow.
Can't that be demonstrably disproven? I mean, there are people in the church who are morbidly obese, and why doesn't he talk about food? He talks about taking care of ourselves. They never talk about eating healthy or... They say, don't do tattoos, don't drink coffee or tea. They don't say anything about that.
Well, and very rarely do you hear them address the issue of evolution ever directly. And although it was kind of indirectly here, just kind of painted with a broad brush those who believe that we evolved, that, you know, that of course we'll have no reverence or responsibility for our own bodies and lives and things like that.
Yeah, the standard cliche.
Yeah, it's sad that we walk around in a world full of just mangy, filthy
animals.
Yeah, that's right. Just the clean, bright Mormons.
Yeah, okay, so bringing up the tail end was Dieter Uchtdorf, who I always enjoy listening to. Mostly because, and I've said this before, but you get down to this talk and you say, you know, you strip away the couple references to Mormonism, even if you strip away the couple references to Christianity, it's just a great talk. You know, it's Uchtdorf is not limited by Mormonism, and he's a great speaker. And you juxtapose him to Christofferson. You know, it seems like they're making such a good move with the Quorum of the Twelve, these vibrant, worldly people who, and worldly not in a bad way, you Mormons, but worldly, understanding the world and be able to communicate. And then they've just put in all these pasty lawyers. Christofferson is a lawyer, after him. And you know, what happened? You almost had the brass ring, guys. He's right here. And then you went with the Quentin Cook and the Christoffersons. Guys, you could have had it.
You blew it all, you bastard.
And he's just really like just kind of charming and very smooth in his delivery. And even when he, you know, kind of almost choked on something, you know, he was able to, you know, turn it into a joke and get the biggest laugh of the session and everything like that. He really knows how to play the crowd.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a smart guy. He's a brilliant speaker. And in a church of, what are we up to now? 16, 20 million, whatever. What's the count? There's got to be more guys like this out there. They got to be there somewhere. I mean, why plumb the depths of Curtin and McConkie for new general authorities?
I know it would, you know, goes back to the 14 fundamentals because they don't have to be trained. And, you know, for all they say that teaching by the Spirit's the best way to do it, I mean, that's all great and good, but a little bit of ability goes a long, long, long way.
Well, it's the care. I mean, like I said, how many of them are, they're almost all businessmen and lawyers and that sort of thing. If Benson was right that the prophet didn't require any training, you would see a statistical sampling matching the work, the working, you know, you'd see like, you know, he was the general manager of, you know, the Bountiful Shopco, and this guy was the, you know, but you don't see that. You see people who are very highly trained to parse and not, and talk and talk and talk without saying anything. That's what we select for. And it's unfortunate. Yeah, it's unfortunate. So for me, bottom line, I liked Holland's talk. I thought it was a nice, you know, sort of feel good thing. I really liked Dieter's talk. I liked the fact that they brought back up the 14 fundamentals. That gave us a lot of stuff to chew on for the next couple months, and that'll spark a lot of arguments online. The other stuff was just sort of you know, standard fare.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Well, agreed. We haven't talked about what Uchtdorf said.
Oh, what do you want to say about what he said?
Was it basically slow down, take it easy?
Yeah,
it was go too fast.
The theme was focus on fundamentals. You know, sometimes when things are going wrong, or when, you know, he talked about turbulence and whatever. He talked about trees and when it gets tough. You need to focus in on what matters the most. And I thought that was a really good talk.
I like the story about the ballpoint pens in NASA.
Yeah, that was a great one. Scott, you want to tell us what that was?
Well, he just told about to prove the point of simplicity about how and getting back to the basics, how in NASA the ballpoint pens wouldn't work up in space, and so they're trying to figure out this problem. So what do they do while they're trying to figure it out? They use pencils. I thought that was a great one.
Right. Yeah.
You know. But ultimately, you know, most everything he said was, you know, standard motivational speaker fare kind of stuff. He didn't, it's like you were saying before, John, I mean, strip away, you know, the couple references to Mormonism in there, and, you know, it could have been at any self-help seminar.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
The church should apply this talk to itself, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, Zilpha pointed out that, that if you compare, like, Christofferson's talk to Uchtdorf's talk, they're sort of in tension with each other. You know, Christofferson's saying, do all this stuff to sanctify yourself and da-da-da-da-da, and Uchtdorf is saying, well, take it easy, you know, focus on the fundamentals, you know, because Christofferson gave the 5 points of things you had to do, you know, purity and labor and all the stuff, active stuff that you need to do, you're not doing enough, and then Dieter comes in and helps us out a little bit. All right. Any other thoughts about the first Saturday session?
That sucked.
You suck. No, I thought it was pretty average, but I did like the 14 points. I thought that was remarkable. That hasn't been. I mean, that talk is 30 years old now.
30 years.
All right. Scott, Tierza, Niall, Devin, thanks for helping us out this morning.
Thank you.
You're free for the rest of the weekend. You know, go do something naughty. Go get a tattoo.
Go be wild.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Right.
Thanks.
Okay, welcome back. Now it's we're just after the second Saturday session, and I'm here with a new group of willing participants. First of all, we have our old friend Bridget. Welcome back, Bridget.
Hey there, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. And he helped us out at our last conference in the spring. Kyle, how you doing, Kyle?
Good. How are you doing today, John?
Good. Now, I was going to have everybody say where they're from. Kyle, where are you from?
I actually just recently moved to Florida, so where I'm from now.
Wow. You're right there in the middle. Well, you only got a little bit left in hurricane season. You guys took it easy this year.
Yeah, I just got here less than a month ago, so I haven't seen any of that.
All right. And Bridget, you're still up in the Chicago area?
That's correct.
All right. And rounding out the panel, we have Nathan. Hey, Nate.
Hi, John.
And where are you from, Nate?
I basically was raised here in the Salt Lake area, Valley, in the Salt Lake area. Grew up close to Draper, and now I'm up in Salt Lake City.
All right. Well, let's get started. I had a lot of more happy things to say about the first session. I must say right now I'm a little bit disappointed in the second session, and I think we'll get there. Session was conducted by Henry Eyring again. He conducted the first session, so I guess they're not taking turns. Maybe they're taking days. We had the vote, the sustaining of the officers, nothing exciting there.
I had something funny happen when that was going on.
Oh, really?
I kind of, you know, when they were sustaining Boyd K. Packer, I kind of mockingly raised my hand to not sustain him. And then my four-year-old daughter turned and slapped my hand back down.
Well, that's what
I
you
guess
get.
The religious indoctrination has taken effect.
Yeah, I think he's looking a little bit better, old Boyd. We're going to hear from him, I suppose, than last conference, but he's looking his age. All right, we were led off by Robert Hales of the Quorum of the Twelve. Kind of an unremarkable talk. Anybody have any thoughts about his?
It. Go ahead, Bridget.
Oh, I had never really given a lot of thought to the fact that agency is kind of an LDS term. Not something, the way Mormons use it, you don't really find it in the dictionary. Because I did a blog post a couple weeks ago about free agency. Because, you know, I've been hanging out with Mormons so long, I just speak their vocabulary sometimes. And one of my commentators was like, isn't free will what Protestants usually call it? And
well, see, Bridget, I think you're already showing agency, as he used it, and free agency are two, they're sister concepts, but they're not exactly the same. Because we can't confuse free agency with free will, which has a whole lot of the nuances. And he's right. He opened by saying, which is a really actually quite interesting thing. He was giving some reading materials on Mormonism to a non-Mormon friend, he said. And his non-Mormon friend came back and said, can you give me some sort of, glossary or something? I'm getting lost in the terminology.
Yep.
And that's where, which is absolutely true, you know, because in the LDS Church, we have defined words into our own thing. As a matter of fact, later on, he said a sentence that I wrote down that just illustrates the point. He said, the plan of mercy to appease the demands of justice. I mean, that's Mormon speak all over it. And you know, nobody from the outside would have any idea what you're saying if you said that sentence. And if they thought they did, they'd probably be wrong. So, you know, he talked a lot about this agency concept, you know, which is you can do whatever you want, but you have two choices, A and B. And if you do B, you don't have any freedom choice. So you have to do A so that you can still choose to do B. Is that the way Mormon agency works?
That's a good summary, I think.
Yeah, I guess I can't say too much about his talk because he went right along with Mormon doctrine. And my problem is with the doctrine because, I mean, it's kind of like if you've got a guy with a gun to your head saying your money or your life. Yeah, you technically have a choice, but, I mean, it doesn't seem like you really have a lot of choice, you know.
I've always thought it was kind of funny that the church builds its entire theology around free agency and then doesn't give you very much of it in practice. But it was just kind of a very basic talk about the plan of salvation and the disagreement between Satan and Jesus in the pre-existence. And is it actual formal LDS doctrine that one-third of
yes.
Once after Satan.
Yeah.
I know that's a huge Protestant tradition, but
I think it's from the Old Testament, probably a book of Isaiah.
It's from Revelation, isn't it?
Revelation.
That the serpent took one-third the stars.
Right, and in the beginning of the book it says, and the stars are angels, so. But Revelation's a little bit spotty. It doesn't really say, did that happen in the past? Is that going to happen in the future? You know, so
there's been plenty of LDS commentary. And, you know, of course, it's that we were all angels in the pre-existence and then one-third rebelled and followed Satan down. And now the demons walking
early,
the earth.
early leaders taught that all the demons who followed Satan were men, that women were all so pure and virtuous that none of them followed Satan.
Really? Right. I did not know
that. There are no daughters of perdition, but...
I never heard that one before.
Well, okay. Yeah, go ahead, Nate.
I was going to say, before we move on from Elder Hale's talk, I thought it was significant that he quoted the story involving King Solomon, where God says to Solomon, destroy Amalek and all his people, stuff, whatever. And Saul's like, well, okay, I will, but, you know, I'm going to keep some of the sheep. And so he obeyed, but selectively. And the point of Elder Hale's bringing up this story was what Samuel said, which is to obey is better than to sacrifice. It's not as important in Mormon doctrine to, probably nothing is as important as obedience. So,
yeah, I mean, that's a good point, Nate. And it's especially telling inside the church where we have become very sort of legalistic with our ordinances and all that sort of stuff, you know, all the work we do on recording names, but still obedience trumps all that. That in the church, obedience is the first law of heaven, and that is absolutely true. You have to obey your file leaders. And I want to make that point again, because oftentimes when we talk about obedience, you think about obedience to the gospel or obedience to the commandments. In the Mormon church, it means both that and obedience to your file leader.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Could I say one more thing about it? Might kind of segue into the next talk.
Sure.
The only thing that really bothered me about his talk is he talked about secularism very briefly.
Yes.
And he set up a straw man that was just, I mean, it's the typical one you hear, but it was just, you know, how secular people believe that there's no good, there's no evil, there's no right and wrong. And that had me yelling at the screen. I mean,
yeah, he set the ball and Quentin Cook punted it, didn't he? Yes, I have to absolutely. Say that Elder Cook is now on my naughty list. And I could not, I was watching conference with my mother and my father, who are both very strong believers. And of course, I am more of a secularist, and the type of bullcrap he was accusing me of personally in front of my mother, I am ashamed and I'm insulted. And his talk, it was an awful piece of trash.
I absolutely agree. I was extremely angered by it. I mean, I consider myself a secular humanist / atheist the same way. And it's like, so I'm not an honest person. I don't know how to treat people well, you know, all this stuff because I don't believe in God. It's just absurd.
He set up, for those of you who have out there who haven't had the privilege, I'm sure it will light up the board soon enough. You'll be able to read his talk. He set up a juxtaposition against those of faith. And not only that, he limited it down several times in his talk by saying Judeo-Christian, and we'll get back to that. But the people of faith against the secularists. And basically, he was saying that that the people of faith, you know, the world needs not only them, but needs them to tell the world what to do. And he went on to say that the values are based in religious belief. And because of that, the religious belief needs equal access to the public square.
As if they don't already get plenty of access. I mean, he talked about the assault on religious freedom. What is he talking about? I don't know what religious freedom is being taken away, at least not in this country.
Yeah, you know, I was sitting there thinking, because oftentimes they give these talks and they talk in vague terms about secularists and secularists lacking morals. You know, he talked about they don't have any moral basis, they don't have any, and normally they don't give anything specific. But luckily he did, and he gave us two things that the world needed, the religious people, because the secularists don't have this. Do you guys remember what those were?
I wrote them down, yeah.
What was the first one?
Honesty.
God damn it, he said honesty. He said that the secularists are not honest because that they have no grounds for honesty. Can you imagine? I mean, I'm just livid that somebody like that can get up in front of all those people and say the people who don't believe in Judeo-Christian. He said Judeo-Christian. So all the Muslims, let's put those guys aside. All the Buddhists, all the Hindus, all the secularists, all the scientists, everybody out there who doesn't subscribe to Judeo-Christian belief has no grounds for honesty. How can someone of his, he's a lawyer for heaven's sakes, how can he really believe that?
I've heard the same kind of argument talking to like other, not Mormons, but other Christians, you know, in debates and stuff, but it's a bad argument and even good theologians don't use it. And I was amazed that this guy who's supposed to be an apostle is using this ridiculous argument.
You know, I used that argument when I was like 16 and got beaten by the atheists in Yahoo chat rooms who are my age. And I realized back then it wasn't a very good argument.
Yeah.
Well, so, it just doesn't bear out. You can't go and show. I mean, there are a lot of great, honest Christian people, and there are a lot of great, honest honest people. Otherwise, go find any secular institution. Pick your institution. Pick, I don't know, the Academy of Mechanical Engineers or Harvard University. I guarantee you in their bylaws, they all have a rule that says you have to be honest and you'll be kicked out of the organization for not being honest. Honesty is such a universal thing because all of our human interactions depend upon that. I don't care if you are a drug dealer. You're going to be honest with your supplier or else he's going to knock you off. You have to be open or there's consequences in every society. To suggest that that comes from Judeo-Christianity is just ridiculous.
Yep.
So besides honesty, what was the second thing then?
Oh, let's talk about the one that's really inflammatory.
Even worse. Even worse.
Even worse. So the first one he says is people who aren't Judeo-Christian have no basis for honesty. And the second one is he said that the Christianity provides the world that all of God's children are brother and sisters, basically, and that in order to have like a brotherhood of man and see ourselves in equal footing, we have to have Judeo-Christian values. Has the man not read the Bible?
It's unbelievable. And then he actually brings up the slave trade. Are you kidding? Like, he needs to read history, not I mean, in addition to the Bible. Unbelievable.
Yeah, Bridget, you had something you want to say about that?
Well, you guys know I'm an evangelical Christian, and I'm studying church history right now, working on my master's degree in it. And something that I'm doing right now is I'm reading The Mind of the Master Class by the Genoveses, and that's a book about the Southern slaveholders and their religion and their morals and what kind of people they were. It just kind of humanizes the Southern slaveholders. And I'm also doing some reading in other 19th century literature. And I've read, the thing is that the slavery issue for Christians, it was a debate on both sides of the matter. The abolitionists, they were opposed to it on humanistic principles, but a lot of them were also opposed to it on religious principles. They honestly believed that if, kind of what Quentin Cook was saying, that if mankind is made in the image of God, then you cannot enslave one to another. So they found ways of interpreting the Bible, reinterpreting the Bible, and finding hermeneutics to argue that the Bible does not condone slavery. Now, I know you guys are saying that's ridiculous, and I know where you're coming from.
No, I would agree with you. I think Christianity neither caused nor you can use the Christian Bible and you can use it to either defend or condemn slavery. So in that sense, it's neutral on slavery. And as a matter of fact, more than anything, that's what the Old Testament is. It's just, you know, treat your slaves well. It doesn't necessarily say free all the slaves. So the people who plied the slave trade, who owned slaves, were God-fearing Christians. And the people who were abolitionists were God-fearing Christians. So you can't say Christianity itself leads to the belief that all mankind are equal. Other than you can say that it's at least a wash on it.
Yeah, I mean, I personally believe that correctly understood, the Bible will lead to that belief, but the key there is correctly understood, and there's a lot of people who will take it and take the slavery parts, and or they would at the time. They would argue slavery, and this was, it was a huge issue for churches back then, though, because, you know, what do you do when somebody converts to Christianity and he has slaves? Are you really going to tell him, you got to get rid of your slaves now, when the Bible is in there and it says things like, slaves obey your masters? So it was a huge nightmare for the Christian church in the 19th century. Now, why all this is relevant is because it was a fight. I mean, Protestants were on the front lines fighting this fight and trying to get rid of slavery. I mean, they were also defending it, but they were trying to get rid of slavery. So for somebody like Quentin Cook to come in and say, oh, by the way, Mormons were against slavery too, and they even kicked us out of Missouri for it. You know, anybody who knows LDS history knows that Mormons were mostly neutral on slavery. We can debate whether or not that was right or wrong, but they had other problems. They had other things that they needed to fight for and that they were struggling with. So they basically took a neutral stance on slavery and said, Joseph Smith even said in 1836 in response, now the Missourians did accuse Mormons of being pro-abolition, and Joseph Smith put out a statement saying, no, we're...
And I hate to change the subject, I don't think it's very much, but I thought it was interesting that towards the end of his talk, Quentin Cook was saying that religion, and maybe he was saying Judeo-Christian religion, but it has a role in encouraging people to treat all people equally. And I kind of scratched my head because that seems to be a common belief, but not necessarily so common in practice. So that was something.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to add on the you know, that Quentin Cook obviously doesn't understand Mormon history, because, you know, there's been a struggle throughout all of Christianity with the issues of slavery, but Mormonism doesn't have a really great record on that. Let's take the facts.
That's the point I want to make, that Mormons were not part of abolitionism. Yes, some of them were opposed to it, but Mormonism as a movement never really lifted a finger to fight slavery. Mormons moved out to Utah. They did more to defend polygamy than they ever did to fight slavery. So for Mormons to come in here now and say, yeah, us too, we were against slavery. No, no, you don't get that. You don't get credit for that.
Well, on All Men Created, well, I mean, first of all, Brigham Young was a slave owner. He didn't free all the slaves he had. There were slaves he kept. He was a slave owner. The pronouncements from the Brethren on the blacks and the history with the church on the blacks of holding them out of the priesthood until 1978, to say, here we are, the Mormon Church, the shining example on race relations, when they still believe in the Book of Mormon, which still says that people are cursed by God with a skin of darkness. You can't say that we are above secularists who, if you go talk to evolutionary biologists, they'll tell you things like there's no such thing as race. They'll tell you things like, you know, genetically we're all interrelated and we don't have a lot of these things that sort of religious people have been telling us for years are important. So for him to say that it's religion that's guiding the way in this brotherhood of mankind, you only have to open a history book and don't have to read very many pages where you find out that's not true. I'm not here to condemn the Christians. I'm just saying that him turning it around and pushing it on the secularists is just insanity.
Right.
Yeah, like you mentioned, brought up the race. I mean, he talked about slavery. He didn't specifically talk about race, but to me, that still falls into the treating people well and, you know, caring about mankind. And we all know that Mormonism has a horrible record on that. And I mean, unbelievable. I don't know.
If he wanted to talk about something that Mormons were good at, he could have talked about suffrage and that Mormons were the, you know, second territory in the nation to give women the right to vote. That would
have been
historically accurate.
I'm not going to say that Mormons aren't honest and that Mormons aren't, but it was his turning like the secularists into demons that really bothers me, and it gets worse if you read the whole talk. It's just, I mean, we're just picking on those two, but it does sort of move into Richard Edgley, his talk. He sort of picked up the ball and ran with it too. He's first counselor in the presiding bishopric, and, you know, under him, the straw man of the secularists continued.
Yep.
Yeah, I just wrote down the summary of his talk was basically no matter what people say, just have faith, logic, reason, all that doesn't matter. Faith is the only thing that matters. Seemed like a direct attack on people like us who actually expect the church to make sense logically.
Well, yeah, he says choose faith. He said choose faith, and he said that against the pessimism and the doubt and despair of secular beliefs. I don't know who he's hanging out with, but I was more pessimistic as a member of the church, sitting around on my food storage waiting for the world to end and the sinners to be burned up in hell. I don't have that sort of pessimism now. Mankind might be able to do something for itself. Why the millennialists call everybody else pessimistic is beyond me.
Yeah, and then doubt and despair, like you, I'm actually much happier where I'm at now. I'm not in despair. I mean, and doubt doesn't mean despair. Doubt just means doubt. That's all it means is questions. And to put having doubt as something that's a sin, he didn't necessarily say it's a sin, but he implied that it's a bad thing to even doubt. I mean,
yeah.
I guess you guys really took a beating this session.
Well, I have a conspiracy theory about this session. Maybe we'll wait till the end. So.
Yeah. It seems that, you know, I've said before, Bridget, that, you know, the early apologetics, or, you know, if we went 30 years ago, 20 years ago, was really aimed at sort of your camp, at evangelicalism. I think they finally woken up and said, wait a minute, the evangelicals also believe in God, and they're really kind of similar to us, and they're really starting to turn their attention to secular issues. But like when they attacked the evangelicals 30 years ago, they didn't quite understand evangelicalism. They still don't understand secularism. I don't mind them attacking secularism. It has its weak points, but these aren't them.
Was this the talk where he specifically mentioned Zarahemla and not knowing where it's at? Or was that a different one?
That might have been either him or Kevin R. Duncan of the 70, the okay. Next speaker.
Just basically, I don't know where it's at and it's okay. And
it was Edgley.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if that works for him, but for a lot of us, the fact that there's no evidence for it does matter, you know, and it's not just going to be faith that's going to get people through that who actually want things to make sense.
Yeah. So the next talker was Kevin R. Duncan of the 70. The first comment I had here was that he needs a fact checker because he was talking about the winner of 48. And he's talking about the Gold Rush. Everybody who's a football fan knows that the Gold Rush happened in 49.
It's true. I didn't even notice that.
My notes get scribbled in angry scrawl after this point, so I have to kind of go through. Any thoughts on Brother Duncan's talk?
I mean, he just basically rehashed a talk, and he even said he was rehashing a talk that was done in the first session, where he rehashed a talk that Benson gave about the 14 fundamentals of following the prophet, which are absurd, most of them.
Yeah, I don't know if you all listened to the first session, but of course they almost read into the, you know, congressional record straight across the 14 fundamentals of a prophet by Benson from 1980. And I was amazed at that. And now I'm double amazed that they read them again, because they are problematic. And something's brewing in Salt Lake City with the prophet. I don't, maybe it's, this is backlash to the Prop 8 stuff. I don't know.
I thought it was interesting that Kevin Duncan said, and I had it because it really puzzled me, but he said, every prophecy Brigham Young made has come to pass. Holy cow.
Yeah.
That's already getting some
statement.
Yeah, wait, I started talking about the 1848. He was talking about how they, you know, there was all this sort of, you know, I don't want to use the word secular, but just the regular stuff, like Brigham Young telling them to plant their crops and to do this and to go here. And yeah, he was really up on that and saying, you know, people have to listen to the prophets because the prophets are all right. My response is, when's the last time the prophets told us to do anything practical? You know, like buy stock in Microsoft or anything. I mean, they don't. It's Brigham Young was all up in your grill about everything. You know, you know even who you should marry and when you should go on a mission. But you know, when why don't we get that sort of direction anymore? I'd be happy to obey them or at least evaluate it if they told me to do something other than, you know, the vague sort of obey us.
Yeah. I mean, I wondered when he talked about the people who didn't follow the prophet and went on to California. I mean, if you're going to really look at this, you need to know what happened to those people. I mean, who's to say they didn't become just as successful wherever they went?
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, that's true. I've said before, you know, we look at Utah and say, well, you know, they planted their crops and their fruit trees and they prospered. That's a sign of God. Well, whose sign is it that Phoenix prospered, or, you know, or Denver or Boise, or, you know, some of those other cities that weren't really big Mormon enclaves? You know, how did they prosper without God's blessing?
It's a great point. I mean, maybe it's just when you plant things and water them, they grow.
Could be. Our next 70 was Garrett Gong of the 70. He talked about missionaries and temple stuff and just a plain old vanilla talk, I think.
He seems really nice. I just want to pick him up and put him in my pocket. He's really cute. I thought he was adorable.
He did seem nice. I probably would have enjoyed his talk more if I wasn't still fuming from Quentin. And then we had Niels Anderson of the 12. And he talked about being offended. Of course, that's a great old gem. And being ashamed. And, you know, the shame part really got me thinking, isn't, you know, why are people ashamed of the gospel? Isn't shame something that religious people teach us? Bridget, maybe you have a comment on that. Why are people ashamed? I'm not ashamed of my beliefs.
I think that you can be ashamed sometimes when people are talking about how dumb your beliefs are and you're just afraid to speak up and say, well, actually, I believe that stuff about the talking snake and the rib woman, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It seemed the offended thing when it came up, I just, you know, whatever. How many times have we heard that one? And then he goes into being ashamed. And what I wrote down as a note was, I don't know of anyone who's ever left the church because they were ashamed. So I don't know what is he saying that's why they leave the church?
Well,
because they're ashamed of it?
I guess he's saying.
It could happen.
Well,
if you were ashamed of what your leaders had said or done, I could see somebody leaving the church over that.
I suppose it's possible. I just don't personally know anybody that I would say that really applies to.
I guess if you take, like, I don't know, irreverent podcasts where they make fun of beliefs all the time, you could interpret that as people being ashamed of their beliefs and leaving the church. But I guess from those of us outside would say, well, that's, you know, people realizing they had some weird beliefs and giving those up. So I'm not exactly sure. But yeah, the offense thing was the same standard thing. And undoubtedly it's true. You know, there's probably people who get offended and leave. But then why should you have to stay and take part in an offensive organization? I mean, I don't know.
He brought up the story of Frederick G. Williams. Does anyone know any more about that? I tried to research and find out why he actually originally left the church, and I couldn't find anything. I was curious.
Well, do you want the real story or the
yeah, the real story? Because obviously the fake story, the easy story is he was offended and left, but I was curious what the real story is.
He left during that same period when most of the early church members left. I can't remember all the details, but at the same time, like Oliver Cowdery and Martin Harris and, okay. You know, in the transition out of Kirtland and the Safety Security Bank and all that sort of stuff, when a lot of people left and became disillusioned with Joseph. So he left during that period. I don't know there's anything like special that, you know.
In this talk, he also actually used the term or talked about how if you don't understand something, to put it on your shelf.
Yeah, I thought that was just an ex-Mormon phrase, and here it is in conference.
Yeah, I did not know that Mormons use that term. I thought that was all of us ex-Mormons talked about that. That surprised me.
Okay, the last talk was Richard G. Scott. How do I say this as nicely as possible? He sounds special to me. I mean, if I didn't know who he was, I would think.
Yeah.
He doesn't sound like he's all there anymore. And
I couldn't follow what he was talking about, to be honest. And I tried. It didn't seem coherent at all.
Two or three notes. You know, there was a lot of. He talked about faith and the plan of happiness and a lot of sing-songy sort of stuff, but
You probably used the word character at least 100 times. And he never defined what he means by character, except for you can't have character if you don't have faith somehow. So
it's strong moral character wrought by consistent right choice. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he speaks very slowly and in a very, it was tough for me. It was tough for me to listen to that one.
I believe that Elder Scott's one of the older general authorities. I don't remember his age, but he's generally a sweet man. I like listening to his talks before, but this one I had a really hard time paying attention to. It just made me feel so tired.
Exactly. That's what it did to me, too. Exactly. So, yeah, maybe it is to age. I don't want to beat him up. I just heard a lot of, like, cliches and buzzwords coming out of his mouth. Yeah. But I have to say again, my experience in this session was overly tainted by Quentin Cook and his dastardly portrayal of my people, and I didn't mention this before, but I think Richard Edgley went on to talk about how basically Mormons are victims, you know, that standard thing, right after Quentin Cook gets up and portrays the enemy as, you know, God. You know, as immoral, you know. So I apologize to everybody after Quentin Cook's. I wasn't listening as well as I could have been.
Okay, Richard G. Scott's only 81. He's not one of the older ones. I was wrong. But
that's middle age for a member of the 12.
Yeah,
I just know 81. I just know that Boyd Packer and Thomas Monson are older. So
yeah.
Kyle, you said you had a conspiracy theory for the session.
I remember when I was growing up in the church, I don't know where I heard this, but they always said that they don't assign topics for conference, that it's just random or whatever. I don't believe it, because this session seemed to be aimed directly at people like us that are leaving the church. Every single talk, it just seemed to go right down the line. Except
I've
for
never
maybe,
believed it either.
And except for maybe Scott's talk at the end, but the rest of them were just a direct attacks. And I don't think they were intended to get us to come back. They were intended to keep people that were still there to not become like us. Or yeah. People like me, anyway.
All right. Any other last-minute thoughts about the – not last-minute thoughts. Any other parting thoughts about the Saturday afternoon session?
I have one. I thought it was interesting that when what's his name? Richard Edgley. He talked about, towards the end of his talk, he talked about that by faith. And then he said, I have witnessed mountains moved, mountains of this moved, mountains of that moved. I was like, interesting.
Yeah, mountains of doubt. Yeah, metaphoric mountains.
Yep. That's all.
All right. Well.
Oh, sorry, John.
No, go ahead, Nate.
I thought it was interesting also that after going on and on about these mountains of various things that he has seen move, then he said, and so when we use words, I testify and I know, basically it's justified. I do testify. I do know, so on and so forth. That's all.
Well, I think they're keeping the troops in line and keeping the enemy at the door. I think that's what the Saturday afternoon session was about.
All right.
Sounds good.
All right. Sorry to
Thanks for having us,
sorry
John.
To bulldoze you over with my tirade, but all right.
I think it's very justified. I felt the same way, John.
Bridget, Kyle, Nate, thanks a lot.